Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
Another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And today is, it's going to be our first episode of 2021. So happy new year, everyone listening.
The C-Lab year.
Yes. Today we have an interesting topic to discuss. We're not going to be talking about one particular board game today. We're going to be talking about many particular board games and for one particular reason. So Matthew, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about our favorite mechanics in board games. Mechanics can be broad or more narrow in this case, more just like the design decisions that go into games and how they manifest in games.
And we're not necessarily talking about like an overarching mechanic. Like, for example, we're not going to say something like card drafting. What we're more specifically talking about is our favorite mechanics unique to specific board games.
Right. These are not going to be the names of Board Game Geek mechanic pages.
Right. So rather than saying card drafting, if there's a particular game that does card drafting in a very unique way that stands out to us and makes it one of our favorite mechanics in a board game, that is the kind of thing that we'll be talking about. I'll ask you this, Matthew. How many mechanics do you have written down?
I have 7, but I might end up thinking of more as we go on.
Interesting. I have more than 7. So let's start by saying we're gonna talk about our 7 favorite mechanics each. We might have some overlap, and we might talk about different mechanics from the same game potentially. We'll just kick it off. How about with your first favorite mechanic that you'd like to discuss?
All right. Yeah, my first favorite mechanic is Decline in Small World. So Small World being a territory control sort of game where you expand your people and then you choose when to go in decline, where you remove all your pieces except for one on each space you control. And then you get a new sort of army to work with. And
right.
What makes Decline so interesting is, for one thing, it's a major scoring component of the game, and mastering when to decline is a huge deal. But
right, it's like bonus income or bonus points if you go into decline at the right moment and you keep your in decline tokens on the board.
Right. For one thing,
an in-decline token, just to be a little more specific, is a token that you no longer control, but until an opponent removes it by conquering it, it gives you passive points for the rest of the game, or right. until you go in-decline with a new army.
Right. For one thing, I like the flavor of it, just the idea of, like, their power is starting to wane, and so, like, they're less powerful, they don't actively seek out new territories, they just kind of live with what they have.
Yeah, it kind of draws a parallel to like ancient Rome, where they conquered most of Eurasia and North Africa, and then they spread themselves so thin that they just couldn't manage themselves anymore, and therefore they went into decline. It's sort of like a same situation in Small World, where once you've spread yourself too thin, your best option is to go into decline.
Right. One thing I really like about Decline, though, is that it is completely up to the player's control when they want to decline. Like, you can technically just hold on to one faction as long as you want. But the thing is, like, with Decline, it kind of takes up a whole turn to do it. And so, like, it seems like a tempo loss at first, but it's one that you completely control yourself. It's like nobody forces you into decline. You're not forced by the game to go into decline. You just kind of work it out for yourself. And I think that sort of like temporary sacrifice mechanic works really well when it's only up to the player who does it. Like, it becomes a resource that you can manage or something you can plan around. And much of the game does become a game about planning around decline.
It's a risk reward decision that's entirely on you.
Exactly.
Control.
It's also, I think, handled pretty well, I think, in the game. You just flip the tokens over, and they have a backside that, like, if there's an ability that doesn't work in decline, it just doesn't show up anymore. So it uses, like, the information that you deal with pretty well.
Right, on your little placard. And also all the pieces in the game have a colored side and then a black and white side. And yeah, you just put the pieces on the board over to show that they're in decline. It's pretty elegant because you're typically managing like stacks of tokens when it's your turn. And at the end of your turn, you leave your tokens in different stacks. So it's pretty elegant just to take each stack you have, flip it over, and take all but one piece off of it. So it doesn't take much time, like, out of the game to manage that sort of thing or to perform that action. It also makes it a very unique, like, war game and area control game, because lots of war games are about, like, starting with your army fully on the board and then whittling it down to nothingness, which, you know, it's sometimes that can lead to, like, a very one-sided and unfortunate experience for the loser. Other times it just feels like a slog to just get rid of everything on the board. But this game encourages people to wipe their own pieces off the board and make more space for new pieces. Okay, let's see. I will go with, for my mechanic that I first want to discuss, the Voyages mechanic in Champions of Midgard. So Champions of Midgard is a worker placement game where you place workers to collect resources and warriors, which take the form of dice in this game. And then you can also place workers to commit those warriors to fight monsters. There are two types of monsters that you can just place your worker there and you'll commit your dice there and fight them without having to spend any other resources. Those are the troll and the draugr. But there are a great deal of other monsters that can give you a great deal number of points at the end of a voyage if you take the voyage action with your worker. So with the voyage, you have to secure a boat, first of all. Then you have to commit a specific number of workers and food resources to the voyage. And halfway through the voyage, you draw a card which tells you whether you lose some of your workers some of your warriors or some of your food. And then you have to feed your warriors with the food that you have remaining to make sure that you get to the end of the voyage. And then at the end of the voyage, you fight the monster. I think this mechanic is really what makes me enjoy Champions of Midgard as a whole, just by adding like a little bit more immersion. I think one of the reasons I like Champions of Midgard is it's one of the more immersive board games that I've played. It feels like you're really like fighting monsters and earning glory and resources because of it, more so than other games. It feels kind of like a role-playing game almost in that regard. But right, I guess
there's a sort of realism to like stocking up for food on a voyage. You don't know exactly how much you'll need, so you have to kind of place your bets on whether you'll get attacked or not.
Yeah, it adds a little bit of drama, which makes the game pretty exciting. The game already has a great deal of drama with a sort of like press your luck combat situation for defeating monsters and earning points with the dice already. But then adding that extra layer of drama where something bad could happen on your voyage and you might not have as many dice as you had committed when you finally get to that monster.
Yeah, and it makes great use of board flow and board design, because when you go on a voyage, you go from like the middle part of the board to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the very bottom of the board is the super monsters.
Right, and the super monsters give you significantly more points than draugr or trolls on average. And if you don't defeat them, they acquire a bounty in the form of like the gold unit, the whatever currency unit the game uses. So after a while, like those monsters are worth a whole lot if you can manage to slay them. But yeah, I think the whole mechanic just like it feels immersive. It's very well designed, like visually, and it adds drama to the situation, and all of that together, like, I think lifts the game up as a whole. If it was just about, like, fighting the trolls in the draugr, I think I would like Champions of Midgard a whole lot less than if it didn't have this mechanic inside it.
It's really designed around the voyages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess food as a resource wouldn't really make any sense. Neither would wood, because the wood is mostly used to build more boats or to build your own personal boat, which I also greatly enjoy that there's an element where, like, not only is it first come, first serve just inherently through the worker placement mechanic, but they take that one step further and the boats that you can build are first come, first serve. I think that's interesting that both, like, parts of this, like the boat buying is a step further from first come, first serve of worker placement, and the drama of the voyage is an extra step on top of the drama of rolling dice to fight monsters.
Right.
And all of that is just implemented with, like, the addition of, I mean, obviously more monster cards, which were already a component in the game, but also the voyage deck. So just by adding a simple deck of small cards, which doesn't have to be super complex, just as long as it adds a little more drama, it goes a long way. Okay. Yeah. Let's hear your second mechanic, unless you have any more to say on this.
No. Okay. So my second is upgrading in Scythe.
Okay.
So Scythe, great game. You know, it has a lot of engine building niftiness. It has a lot of mechanics that use the same components in multiple ways, very multi-purposed. Each of the four main sort of improvements you can make on your player board, your factory board, all kind of have the same element of multi-purpose, but I think upgrading is my favorite because it is the most simple in how it works, or most straightforward. So there are cubes at the top of the board that block bonus effects you get from taking actions. And then at the bottom of the board, you have your costs that it takes to, like, build mechs or build buildings or upgrade more. And the costs have these little indents as well where cubes can go. Whenever you upgrade, you move a cube from the top row to the bottom row, so you get an extra reward from doing one action, and one action on the bottom becomes cheaper. And it's so well implemented, you're just unveiling and covering spaces, so it only really plays off of, like, what's visible to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you don't have to worry about extra rules for, like, if you have two upgrades on this place, then you get this bonus. It uses that heads-up information very well.
I like that there's a whole lot you can do within this system, but the system itself is very easy to grasp, and making your decision doesn't take a whole lot of thinking. Like, all you have to think about is, like, what do I want to do more of with my actions, and what do I want to spend less on? But there's so many, like, further-reaching implications for each of those decisions that you may or may not have already thought through. But when you make the decision itself, it's pretty simple, like, what you're trying to do.
Right. Every decision helps in some way, especially because you're always reducing the cost of something that can give you victory points, or give you stars at least. But also, it's almost easier to make a decision because any cube from the top can go anywhere on the bottom. So, like, you don't have to make a hard decision over, like, sacrificing a good cube from the top for getting a better spot on the bottom. If you want to move one specific cube from the top, you can do that, even if you want to put it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it gives you a lot of freedom to upgrade in the order you want. But also, I think that makes it easier, because if you have a favorite action, then you can just do that.
You I think one thing to, like, I like about the hoops. Construction of this mechanic is just that it's like, it's. I don't think any other game has utilized this like indented placard as well as Scythe has. I think the Fallout official, like, Fallout game attempted something like this with its player placards, but Scythe does it so well, and it hasn't really been replicated yet. And I think that's one thing that makes it just sort of stand out. It makes it very unique and memorable. But it's also, like, the absolute, like, perfect decision for a mechanic like this.
It helps, you know, set up a lot.
It does help set up. It helps you, like identify it from the start of the game. Like, you look at your pieces and you kind of understand, in a weird way, like, what you're supposed to be doing with them.
Yeah, I think it's just, it conveys all that information super well. All right, so what's your second?
I'm gonna play off your the theme of your suggestion, or the theme of your mechanic, where it's about, like, elegant use of components, and I'm gonna bring up the dice in Coimbra and how they are used. And I think there's also an element of like just the component design itself making it very easy to manipulate, easy to use, and somewhat intuitive and also mechanically relevant. So the way that Coimbra works is the actions that you take, the amount of resources that you spend, and the resources that you gain at the end of your turn are all determined by a single die, three single die, but each die has different implications for each of those parts of your turn. So the way that Coimbra works is that at the beginning of a turn, a whole pool of dice are rolled, and each player chooses one of those die, places a little player like stand thing around the die so that it doesn't, you know, shift faces. The face that it rolled remains face up. And also the player standy thing has a color to it to link it with that player. And then that player places that die in this grid, which will determine the order that players take actions based on the number that you rolled, but also the amount of resources that you have to spend when you take your action to acquire cards in the game. So the number you roll, the higher it is, means like the sooner you get to take your turn, and there's a limited supply that you're drafting resources from. But then the higher it is also means you have to pay more. So it's meaning two things there. But then later on in the turn, at the end of your turn, the color of each die that you drafted determines what resources you gain. So there's like a resource that corresponds to money. If you drafted a yellow die, then that yellow die will give you however much money you get to earn at the end of your turn. It determines your income. And there's four colors of dice, I think, maybe five. I think there's a wild color. But I think it's just really neat and elegant how a die can mean so many things. There's other games where dice mean many things, but I think in this game, it has that built-in like risk reward or trade-off that you have to make versus like buying your thing sooner but having to pay more for it. And also, in addition to it meaning one thing, it means an entirely separate thing. So you have to balance out whether you're drafting dice based on getting the cards you want, or you're drafting dice based on whether you're getting the resources you want at the end of your turn. And because those resources directly correspond to purchasing more cards in the first part of the turn, then it kind of makes this natural loop where one turn you might just focus more on the color of the dice so that you have the correct number of resources, so that next turn you could focus more on the priority and the cost that you're paying with those dice now that you have those resources from the previous turn. And it loops and goes on until the end of the game.
I don't have much else to add on to that other than, yeah, it's
pretty elaborate.
It's one of the most clean uses of having like the color and the number of the dice matter that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I have seen games where the color matters, like a role player, but I think Coimbra just does it so smoothly. Like, there aren't too many decisions to make. Oftentimes, mm-hmm. there's like a few good ones, and that determines what you want your dice to be. And I think that's just really helpful, is that even though they all do like different things, it's easy to kind of weigh those options.
Mm-hmm. I think what an interesting thing to point out is, like, you bring up role player. There's also the game that we recently reviewed, Castles of Burgundy, that uses a similar like dice can mean many things style mechanic. But Coimbra has this and does not have a need for dice manipulation. And so it's like, even though the dice are quite complicated, the game ends up being a little bit mechanically lighter than those games because you don't need that extra dice manipulation mechanic tacked on to make sure things are going the way you want.
Right. It doesn't use like specific numbers on the die faces. It's mm-hmm. more about numbers relative to other numbers, whether yours is higher or lower than other numbers that people have.
Mm-hmm. Dice are so meaningful in that game. You know, there's so many different things that you can take away from the die rather than just the one thing that you're trying to do with it. And so therefore, like, the color of the die could make it so that it doesn't really matter what the face is, or the face of the die could make it so that it doesn't really matter what the color is, and you have no need to manipulate those sorts of things.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, what else? What do you got?
My number three is from a little game called Dead of Winter, and it's just The Pile. I don't actually remember what it's called, but so Dead of Winter is a survival game with worker placement elements. It has a hidden traitor mechanic, but part of the hidden traitor mechanic is figuring out if there's a hidden traitor or not, because there just could not be a hidden traitor sometimes. But I think in the end, you still want to have that tension, because even if there's not a traitor, you kind of want people to think there might be. And part of the way to do that is to make a situation where the players can't trust, or they can't 100% know that the other players are cooperating. They have to trust. And the way Dead of Winter does this is that every round, there is a objective that all the players have to work together to complete, or else they will get like a pretty big penalty. And the way this works is everybody contributes cards to a face down pile. And at the end of the round, the pile is revealed. And depending on what all symbols show up for, like food or gasoline or stuff like that, you either meet the objective or you don't. And what this means is that people can like say that they're going to help by putting in a card, like, oh, I can contribute food. And then if they're the traitor, they could contribute something else that's not necessary. Or if they are not the traitor, they can contribute something that is helpful. And there is the element of, like, if a traitor bluffs and puts in something bad, then they would have to claim that somebody else is a traitor because somebody put in the bad thing. But even then, I think what's really powerful is the fact that when you're revealing cards, there is still tension. Mm-hmm. Even when everybody cooperates, you still don't quite know if there's a traitor or not. But there is still the relief after, like, the process of revealing cards. You know, revealing cards from a stack takes time, and that time is like a buildup.
Mm-hmm. And even if all of the cards are correct, that doesn't mean that nobody's the traitor for that round. The traitor could have just participated anyways in the positive outcome for the group.
Exactly. I think Dead of Winter, like, the dead in the winter are two very big dangers that the player constantly has to weigh the risks of going through. But the fact that the sort of survival, like, stronghold they have also has this dangerous element that can be really anxiety-inducing, for lack of a better word, is really powerful for the game's atmosphere.
All right. My next mechanic that I would like to discuss is blending in Kittens in a Blender.
Oh, no.
I think this is another example of utilizing components and table space to make the pieces more than they are, like the game amounts to more than the sum of its components. The mechanic in question is just the whole point of the game in general in Kittens in a Blender is there is a box in the center of the table. It is the game box itself converts to a game piece with Kittens in a Blender. It is divided, the lid is the counter, I believe, where kittens are safe, the counter is the space between. The lid is called a box, and the base of the game box is called the blender. And on your turn, you are responsible for placing kittens into one of those two spaces, or on the counter between them. The kittens in the game belong to different players' factions, if you will. So there's like the blue kittens, the green kittens, the pink kittens, and the yellow kittens. And eventually, when a blend card is played, all of the kittens in the box are saved for the rest of the game, and they are worth 1 point for each player had their kitten of their faction saved. And the kittens in the blender are blended, and they're put under the box to show that they have been blended. And they are worth -2 points at the end of the game for whoever was responsible for that kitten. And then any kittens that are on the counter at that point then leap into the blender for a little added drama. But I think, it's a dark game done very silly and tastefully with its cute illustrations and lack of any gore or actual violence towards animals. in the artwork or really anything other than the mechanic called blending and the name of the game, Kittens in a Blender. But I think just like seeing your stack of kittens in that blender waiting for the blend to happen is a very tense situation. There's a whole lot of drama baked into that. And then when it finally happens, just seeing that big stack of cards sit under the blender for the rest of the game is heartbreaking in a very silly way that I personally enjoy.
I want to mention
also
that.
Oh, go ahead.
I want to mention that Kittens in the Blender has a pretty small box, like typical small card game size. And so the lid in the base of the box are pretty decently sized components. They're not too big, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's not like you have your box for like any other board game we discuss sitting in the middle of the table. Like they'll fit on even the smallest of tables. Yeah, you have plenty of room to play this game. I think also one thing that's kind of fun is that if it is a particularly carnage heavy game, then the pile underneath the blender can get quite tall, and it makes the blender like it's almost kind of like the blender is sitting on top of like a mountain of bodies.
Oh no.
And it can be elevated quite high off the surface of the table. So I think there's also just like this three-dimensional element to the game, like modifying how the table like is set up. It modifies the landscape of the table when you blend these kittens.
That's some like emergent comedy.
Yes, it is. The kittens are also very cute. Anyway, it's funny. I think Kittens in a Blender is a wholly unique game. And I haven't seen any mechanic like that that uses the box of all things for such a thing. I enjoy how Werewords holds the pieces for the gameplay and has a divider for dividing the two different types of pieces in Werewords, but Kittens in a Blender takes that to the next level, literally.
Yeah. Okay, so I couldn't
number three.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I knew I wanted to have one mechanic by D. Brad Talton Jr., but I couldn't decide on which mechanic, so I have two from two different games.
Okay.
I can do these as separate entries or as one entry right now.
Whatever you think.
Okay. Fine. Well, I'll just do one for now, which is The Shop in Millennium Blades. This is one that isn't necessarily for mechanical strength alone, but that's because Millennium Blades has a very, very clear theme it's trying to convey, which is the trading card game lifestyle. And The Shop, the way it works, is a great emulation of that, where there are face-down cards on a grid, basically, and all of them have a pretty flat price, I believe. The backs of the cards are meant to look like booster packs, with the idea that you are buying booster packs to try and pull a card that you need for your setup. It should be noted that the whole point of Millennium Blades is you're getting cards to then go to a quote-unquote tournament with its own quote-unquote metagame. Or there is also the fact that you can get promo cards, which require you to trade in other cards, but oftentimes they can be junk. Or you can sell cards to the shop, which gives you more money based on how high of a star level the card is, which is sort of it's the game's stand-in for a power level. So if it's a powerful card, you'll get more money. But then other people can buy those cards. So if you sell a powerful card, somebody else might want to buy it. And it is a great sort of approximation of the hecticness of like going to a tournament, realizing you forgot one card in your deck, and then like frantically running up to the counter and being like, oh god, do they have it in the case? Do they have it in the binders? Do I have to trade with somebody? Do I have to open a pack? Like, that energy is so perfect. And when you're playing in real time mode, everybody is like throwing around wads of cash and reaching for the deck or the shop grid. And, you know, quickly, like, looking at the cards they have, seeing if they have any junk they can sell that they don't need, seeing what they can trade in. But all of this is facilitated by that shop in the secondary market, sort of. I think that's sort of what I think D. Brad Talton does best, is that sort of emulation of a concept in board game form. In Millennium Blades, creating the energy of the last chance before a tournament is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So how about your number four?
Okay, for my number four, I'm going to talk about Power Grid's supply and demand shop. I think this is, there's not a lot to be said about this shop. It's just, I think, another elegant use of, in this case, the board and the shop for resources that not a lot of games use, but makes a lot of sense, especially in sort of like a modern market type of game. It works pretty simply. There's just a row of spaces where you place the resources in the game, and then in whatever the turn order has been established as, players buy from the furthest amount, or the furthest spaces where the resources are kept, as much as they want. But like the farther you go into the pool of resources that you're purchasing from, the more expensive it gets. So the rarer the resource gets, the more expensive it gets. And so this leads to a lot of situations where either like you know that other players are competing for similar resources because you can see what kind of resources they need to power their power plants. So you might prioritize buying them first, because you know that if you don't do it now, they might be way too expensive later. Or you might just be trying to shut them down and buy the resources you know they need, so that they have to spend way more money on the resources. But then in addition, it leads to situations where like certain resources might be too expensive for anyone to really consider worthwhile purchasing. And those resources will then pile up after another turn or so until the point where they're extremely cheap for what they are, leading more people to desire buying them. So it's just a really elegant use of the concept of supply and demand in a board game that not a lot of other board games can replicate, using the money system in the game. I think when other board games have supply and demand, it doesn't necessarily translate to like a marketplace, like of goods, like a modern marketplace. It's more just about scarcity than having to pay more or less for rarer or more in supply resources.
Also, I do want to mention that the resources that are rarer in real life are rarer in the game, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can draw some very obvious parallels to like why certain things, it makes sense why certain things are in more supply or more demand or cost more to buy. There's also a slight supply and demand element to building your power stations on the map in Power Grid, because each city has three locations where you can build, and the later the game goes, but the more buildings that have already been built there, the more expensive they are. So it's a similar situation where if someone gets to it first, then you'll have to pay more later. Comparing that to other similar types of games where it's sort of like if someone gets there first and that's it, it's just taken up and you have to go somewhere else. Something like Ticket to Ride. It's like if someone takes it first, that's just it. It'd be interesting if like in Ticket to Ride, if like the secondary tracks that run parallel to another track just had races on it.
Hmm.
That's sort of what could happen. But it's what does happen in Power Grid. And it's nice when an important mechanic like the supply and demand marketplace is sort of like echoed in other parts of the game. It gives the whole game a sort of nice like texture and feeling.
Cohesion.
Yeah, that's good. Good word. Yeah. My number four.
So my other D. Brad Talton Jr. mechanic is bases in Battlecon. So Battlecon, fighting game, card game, hybrid, inspired by things like, you know, Street Fighter, Guilty Gear, what have you. Every character plays pretty differently with their own unique mechanics and objectives and things like that. But every character shares the same base attacks. The way it works is when you do an attack, you play a base in a style. The style modifies the base, but the base is mostly like the important part as far as well, the base of the attack. So, like, a character can modify a strike with more range, but it's usually not going to be as significant as a shot, which is the base that has a high range. Or every character has a dash, which doesn't really... It doesn't deal damage, and so styles don't work with it, but every character has the same resource in that case that does the same thing. So, like, why it's so useful is because in games like BattleCon with a lot of different characters, it's very hard at times when you're still first learning the game to, like, remember what each character's attacks are, even though the game comes with, like, information displays that you give to your opponent that show all your options for your character. It's still hard to kind of keep track of those, but you can always remember what the bases are because you have them in your hand as well. So you don't have to think about it in terms of, like, style versus style. You can be like, okay, they just played a dash, so they can't dodge my attacks easily. So if they need to play safe, they might play a strike or a block or whatever. Something like that.
It helps that each of the base cards in BattleCon are sort of like the prototypical ideal of, like, what that card does. So if you examine your opponent's situation and you identify that, like, they need a card that does something like shot does or something like dash does, then you don't have to guess, like, are they going to play dash or are they going to play the card that they have that's a lot like dash, you know? Like, there's really nothing else like dash and nothing else like a lot of the other cards in the base. And when there are parallels between, like, a card and a card that a specific unique character has access to for their bases, then you know, like, okay, it's usually for the cards that are sort of, like, average usage that have, like, only slight differences. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah,
like, you don't have to guess too much about what the parameters you're dealing with are, because those parameters are set by bases that you're encouraged to use because they're the best at what they do.
Right. Yeah, bases are all unique. They don't really overlap a whole lot. And so it's easier to kind of piece those together.
All right, let's see. So are we calling that your fifth, or are we
that was my fifth?
Fifth. Okay, so I'll go on to my fifth. And my fifth, let's do, oh gosh, I still have a bunch written down, but I'm trying to figure out which ones I like more than the others. Let's do Brave and Cowardly in Broom Service as my fifth.
Ooh, good choice.
So trick-taking is an interesting mechanic that has a lot of different uses. The way that Broom Service does its trick-taking is it's similar to other trick-taking games where one player plays a card and everyone else has to play their cards that match the suit, if you will, of the card that was played. But each card in Broom Service has two effects that correspond to it, and one of them is the Cowardly effect, which is worse than the Brave effect, but happens no matter what. The Brave effect is typically better, like 2 to 2.5 times better tempo wise to the Cowardly effect, but only the last player to have declared that they are taking the Brave action in any given trick actually gets to take it. Anyone else who declared that they were going to try to take the Brave action but fails to because someone else did takes no action instead for that trick, I guess. On the one hand, it makes trick-taking very interesting. It forces you to, like, examine your opponent's positions and try and guess which cards they have in their hand so that you could predict whether it's safe or not, or the degree of safety to attempting the Brave action versus the Cowardly action on a card. And sometimes you can just plan your whole turn around only taking Cowardly actions and say, like, even if I only took the Cowardly actions, I would still have a decent turn. But on top of that, in order to choose the Brave or the Cowardly action, the game specifically states that you have to say, I am the Brave Hill Druid, or I am the Brave Valley Witch. I think I just totally mixed up those. By the way, I think it's a Valley Druid or a Hill Witch. Either way, you have to speak in the first person per the rules of the game in order to play the cards. So you are calling yourself Brave or Cowardly as you play the game, which I think is a really fun extra element on top of this. Not only does it make the trick taking very interesting and unique to this game, but also it adds that verbal like participation element to the game, and it's kind of like a role-playing element on top of all of that, by the way. It's up to you, it's up to the player whether they do something or not, similar to the very first mechanic we discussed, the In Decline from Small World. Like, it ultimately comes down to you whether you're going to declare yourself brave or cowardly.
Also, it's very funny that you call yourself cowardly when you take the action that is weaker but more likely to succeed. I think there's some comedy in that.
Yeah, I enjoy games, as evidenced by some of my other choices in this list. I enjoy games that have a sort of light comedy element to it that isn't necessarily reliant on the mechanics, but is just a result of the way that the mechanics work. And not only do the mechanics do something interesting in the context of the game, they also just add that extra little fun element.
Mm-hmm.
And some games should be fun.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. That's my fifth.
So switching genres a bit, this is from a living card game, so a competitive card game, but it still is really interesting. My sixth is Primary Servers from Android Netrunner. I haven't played the original Netrunner, which is why I specified Android Netrunner. But so in Netrunner, one player is a corporation trying to literally advance their agenda, which gives them victory points. And the other player is a runner, which is like a hacker trying to hack those agendas and leak them before the corporation can successfully score them. And when the corporation, or the way the corporation does this, is they create servers that house the agendas, and then they block the servers with ice, which is like firewalls and stuff like that, that the runner has to install tools to get out and go through. But so what's really cool is that the deck, discard, and hand of the corporation are also servers that the runner can make a run on. They can target and attack. And there are ways to score points from each of these. If there's an agenda in the discard pile, the runner scores it. If the runner reveals the top card of the deck and it's a... Or no, I think they discard the top card of the deck. And then if it's in the discard, you can check it to see if it's an agenda. And then also there's something similar where you can discard a random card in the corporation's hand, and if that's an agenda, you can score it. So you can either wait for the corporation to make servers, which can be kind of risky because it takes a long time to actually score the agendas, but that's how they get points, obviously. Or you could be proactive and like run at their main servers to try and get agendas early. But also, not many other card games treat the hand, deck, and discard as like physical objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of card games where you can like take cards out of your discard pile, like Magic, Yu-Gi-Oh! Pretty much every competitive card game has a discard element. But there aren't any that treat that as a place in universe that like you can just go to and interact with, but also one that you can block.
It almost makes this card game feel more like a war game in like how you're observing the table and considering its elements.
Right.
It makes it very three-dimensional.
You can defend all of those primary servers in the same way by like putting ice in front of it. So yeah, it's like in a lot of card games, you're attacking the player directly. But because Netrunner has this whole agenda element, you don't attack the player. You attack these like core zones of the game.
Right. And it would make sense to make the game that way, because the corporation isn't just one person that you're fighting with. Like in Magic the Gathering, you're fighting against another planeswalker who is a one person by themselves. Or in Commander, it's like you're fighting against a commander. But in this game, the corporation is kind of an abstract entity that has a lot of elements to it. And so dividing it, it's like you're not really looking at your opponent as one person. You're looking at your opponent as this combination of parts, like these departments and structures that all together form one corporation.
Right. And it also is like, running these isn't just to get points, because running the hand also is like a information gathering aspect, and then running the deck can also hurt the opponent's engine, because if you discard something good, then they don't have it, obviously. So I was just going to say that it has other uses than just scoring.
It's also quite elegant that other card games have effects similar to these, where you can like mill the top card of a deck or force a player to discard cards from their hand to like make them lose tempo or have to get rid of crucial pieces to their strategy. But it elegantly makes these mechanics part of the game using the same mechanic that you use to like attack, you know, what would be to like attack the player, where you run at their remote servers to try and find the agendas that they're scoring on the table. It's sort of like, in addition to that, you can also force them to discard or force them to mill a card using the very same mechanic that you would use to attack one of their agendas to try and take it from them before they can score it.
It's also worth noting that this adds tension for the corporation player as well, because if they don't play the agendas, then they end up stranded in their hand, where they're more likely to get stolen. Mm-hmm. So, like, if the corporation player is only playing ICE or remote or like server upgrades or other cards that just kind of help them out, then the runner has a pretty clear possibility of just stealing something from the corporation's hand. So, yeah.
Another extra little element to the point I just made is that the corporation also uses the same mechanic to defend it as they would their remote servers.
Yeah.
So it's a little just an elegant addition to these pieces of the game. And yeah, I do like that it initially puts the heat on the corporation to start defending themselves. Okay, let's see. My sixth mechanic will be, I'll do the pawns and cubes from concept. Okay. As my sixth mechanic. So this is concept is a game that's entirely about getting your other players to guess something, similar to like charades or Pictionary. But the way that you get it is there is a board filled with icons, and using pawns and cubes, you indicate which icons are important and how the player should sort of mentally draw connections between them to guess the word that you are attempting to get them to guess. So there are five or six pawns of different colors, and then each pawn has 10 matching cubes or so. The pawns are sort of like the main idea, and the cubes are meant to help elaborate on the main idea. One specific pawn, the green pawn, is like the very primary idea. So like it's the one word that you could use to describe something. If you're trying to get someone to guess, you know, Superman, then you would place the pawn on the fictional character space, or maybe you might put the pawn on like the male person space, or masculine person space. And then the cubes just sort of elaborate on that. So like you could place the green pawn on the fictional person space and then put the cubes like on the colors blue and red to indicate the color of his costume. Put the pawns like on the flexing arm to show that he's strong, and maybe something about clouds or flight or something to show that that's one of his powers, he can fly. And then you have these other pawns. So if that's not enough to get someone to guess your main idea, you can use your other pawns to like elaborate, like his costume has an S. So maybe you put, you know, one pawn on like someone's clothing, and then you try to indicate the S. You could put the pawn on like another fictional character and describe another character from the universe, and maybe that'll help someone guess Superman. I think the thing that I like most about this mechanic is it's incredibly versatile, and the game encourages you to use the pieces as creatively as you can possibly imagine. So not only can you use just the pawns to draw one basic connection between one symbol and another, but you could also use the pawns to create like structures or statues or shapes, or indicate things more directly. Like you can stack three pawns on the person space to indicate that there's three people, or you can stack a great big tall tower of pawns on something to indicate something's height, or you could make two piles to show like a relative height.
Yeah, it also is the fact that some of the hard like topics to guess are pretty hard to guess. So it's rewarding to come up with an elegant way for yourself to describe them using these shapes.
It's interesting to like sort of identify or address like when you need to remove pawns from the board too. And that's always an option, is you can just take the pawns off the board. It's unlike in like Pictionary, you can't really take your time to erase something that you've drawn. And in Charades, you can't like shake your hands and make everyone forget an action you just tried to take. But in this game, like, you can rearrange them however you want and like very actively respond to what players are thinking.
Well,
and
sometimes
also,
that doesn't work for us. But...
sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes, but it gives you the option. And once you think you've got it all out there, you can just kind of like let it sit there and people can just observe the clues that you've given.
It's also nice because concept is made to be played with a pair of people as the person giving hints, and cubes are really easy to coordinate with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can both manipulate them, you can take cubes and move them around, you can each be working on like a separate idea, which isn't the best idea, but you can do it.
Yeah, compare that to Pictionary. It's hard for two people to draw the same picture at the same time, even if they had two pencils.
Right. Okay.
All right, that is my sixth. So we are getting into our seventh, which may be our final. I might have some honorable mentions after this one.
Yeah, I did think of a few honorable mentions as well while doing this.
Okay.
My last one I have, though, written down is Leaving the Room in Betrayal.
Okay.
So this is kind of a stretch to call it a mechanic, but it is something the game kind of tells you to do. So Betrayal at House on the Hill, one person becomes the traitor, they leave the room. That is the mechanic. I mean, they come back later. But, I mean, I've talked about this, I think, on our Betrayal episode and on our Betrayal Legacy episodes, that the sheer, like, incredible psychological effect of having the traitor leave the room, like, kind of do their own thing and then come back is incredible. So,
yeah,
like,
it's almost like you look at them differently after.
Exactly.
They come back.
I think it's like, it's hard to really describe, but when you're sitting down at a table, you have like that whole magic circle of like getting involved in the game, immersed, maybe kind of everybody's playing the same game together, and the tone is, you know, pretty light at the start. But by somebody leaving the circle and coming back, it feels like they've betrayed you, that they've broken this bond, and it helps reset the game's tone, because it's no longer sort of a Scooby-Doo romp through a haunted house. It's now fighting for your life. It has like a nice breather. It's sort of like a halftime between the first and second part of the game.
Right.
But
it's
also
unfortunate when a lot of other games like force people to take their time and like stop playing the game for a moment to like read a new rule or like that like disrupts the action. But this is a very, very necessary like pause in between like the two acts of the game.
There's been so many times where people have like gotten a drink or taken the dog out during this break, and I think it's kind of beautiful that that exists. It's kind of nice. But like the idea of somebody moving physically away from the table and coming back is so like no other game has really done that after Betrayal. Even though it's been how many years since that came out? Like at least 10? Maybe a little less than 10? But like, I don't know. There's something about it that is so mystifying. It's so, like, just the idea of beyond the table space is something that isn't really explored that much.
I think it's, it feels to me a lot like something that you would implement in like a role-playing game where you have to take someone aside to tell them something as the dungeon master. It's sort of what the game does, like, since the mechanics or the rules of the game is a dungeon master of sorts in a role-playing style game. I have a mechanic written down, an additional mechanic from Betrayal written down, that also is sort of role-playing game inspired that I think I'll mention in my honorable mentions. But yeah, it's like, I guess the line between role-playing game and board game is a little blurry, and at times some board games skew towards it. And I think it's those like very narrative inclined games like Betrayal that have role-playing elements that benefit a lot from these like dramatic beats.
Yeah.
Okay, so for my seventh mechanic that I'd like to discuss, my seventh mechanic is the sunlight and shadow mechanic in photosynthesis. I think when I think of like a mechanic that's entirely unique to a game, that adds so much to the game. I mean, this mechanic is the entire game, basically. I guess there's also the slight element of the height of the tree in photosynthesis lending to like how far away it can plant a seed. That's the one other mechanic in this game. But sunlight and shadow in this game in photosynthesis, essentially there's this rotating sun that goes on the six corners of the hexagonally arranged board. And wherever the sun is at the start of a turn, it casts light across the board, and a tree absorbs that light if it is not in the shadow of another tree. And a tree casts a shadow depending on its height. There's like three heights to trees in that game. There's like the short height, which casts a one space shadow, the medium height, which casts two space shadow, and the tall height, which casts a three space shadow. And as long as a tree is in the shadow of another tree that is equally tall or taller than itself, then it does not collect any sunlight. And so this game, like the sunlight and shadow mechanic combined with just the tree, the sun rotating around the board, completely defines like what kinds of strategies there are to the game. Like, where do you build your trees so that they collect the most amount of sunlight for you and cast the most amount of shadow for your opponents, at least at different points of the game, because the sun, by flipping all the way to the other side of the board, inverts the shadows and sunlight from where it was. So, you know, you'd want a short tree on this side of the board when the sun is near it, and then a taller tree when the sun's on the opposite side of the board so that it's not in shadowed. It's three-dimensional, like a lot of the mechanics that I've listed, which is a feat for games made out of flat or somewhat small components. It forces you to think spatially and think ahead of time. It's elegant. It makes sense that a taller tree casts a higher shadow, and a taller tree can still collect sunlight from behind a smaller tree.
The
whole game that revolves around it. It's educational, sure. None of the other mechanics we've mentioned up until now have been educational in nature. Speaking of nature.
Decline, sort of.
Maybe, although...
You made the case for it.
I did, but I don't think the Romans wanted to go into decline.
Sure.
They just accidentally did.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are our seven mechanics that we... felt they were our favorites that I think we feel make the game what they are. They're unique to the game, they're elegant, well implemented, and they add a whole lot to the games that they're in. I have a couple honorable mentions, so we can go into those now.
Yeah,
first of
too.
All, I just want to mention the skill system in Betrayal, which I think is a pretty elegant, like pared down rules version of like how role-playing games work, with like rolling dice and stuff. You're still rolling dice, but the dice are simpler. It's just you roll a number of dice equal to whatever your skill is, your skill level is, and then also those skills function separately as health bars, and as you take damage your skills decrease, and it adds in addition to that a sort of like a desperation kind of feeling where you get worse at a skill, and because you're worse at it, then you take more damage from the things, and everything just sort of compounds.
Of my honorable mentions, I guess I'll start with the way workers work in Architects of the West Kingdom. This is a game we got recently and we've been playing recently. I didn't include it because it feels kind of early to put it on an actual list of my favorite mechanics. Mm-hmm. But it has a very strong first impression.
Yeah, I think this I'm willing to say we'll discuss this game next. This will be the next episode.
Oh, probably.
Just a little sneak preview for the near future. But yeah, I agree. This is a unique mechanic when it comes to worker placement games. This does it differently in a good way. It adds a lot to the game, the way that the workers work. It feels a little too soon to declare like it's one of my favorite mechanics, but it is quite good. And I think we'll just shortly say that essentially the way it works is that instead of having a period of the game where you take your workers back, every player starts with a whole lot of workers and you leave them on the board until other actions might take them off.
In a similar vein, I really like Planet.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the whole game is one mechanic, which is putting tiles on a dodecahedron.
I'm pretty sure Planet and Photosynthesis are made by the same people, so it makes sense that sort of a slightly educational, unique component mechanic.
I think that's just Blue-Orange.
Yeah.
They do a lot of that.
Yeah, Blue-Orange. But yeah, Planet with its magnetic dodecahedron, where you place tiles on a sphere, basically, with different terrains to create a planet, and then, you know, depending on how the terrains are arranged, different animals will want to come to your planet and you'll score points for that, or they'll go to your opponent's planet. It has a really fun like manipulation aspect to it. Same thing with Dice Forge. I like Dice Forge's dice face replacement mechanic. I think it's similar to like Mystic Veil's sleeves mechanic with transparent cards. It's really nifty, but I don't think it adds an intense amount of depth to the game.
Yeah.
The way that some of these other mechanics, and it doesn't add to me, for me personally, it doesn't add like that extra like emotional element that a lot of our mechanics had to them.
Right. The other two I have are the gavel in Magic Maze, which is just hilarious. It's a way to remind somebody that they have to do something, but it's useless at telling them what they have to do. It just is like snapping at somebody to wake up. Mm-hmm. Also, it does add drama, but more literal drama, because it will get people upset. And Magic Right. Maze is a game that works best, I think, when it like starts to fall apart. It is sort of a heist in that regard, where like, if you work perfectly, then that's cool because you pull it off perfectly, but it really shows its quality when you have to improvise.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets really hectic.
Alternative like communication methods as a whole are very interesting mechanics, but like just saying people can't talk is starting to become less of a unique mechanic, and so that's why I didn't think to add something like that to this game. Or to this discussion. But yeah, the gavel itself is sort of like part and parcel to the fact that you can't talk. And it does add that little like jolt and like it adds an audio element to the game, like where you bang it to get someone's attention, which I do think adds a lot more than just a simple like piece can add.
Yeah, there is also something powerful of passing something to somebody to tell them they have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Passing the buck, if you will, but not really. My last honorable mention is Camels in Camel Up. Just this is more component design wise, but it uses a really clever component design that both illustrates the game's theme, but also fits with the whole race concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it allows it to create a smaller like racetrack. Because camels can still be in a row, and it adds a lot of excitement, because like you never really know what camel's going to end up on top, quite literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get extremely surprised at what exactly occurs over the course of a turn in Camel Up, because like there's one arrangement of camels or order of operations that you hadn't considered, and when it happens it like totally ruins your plans for the turn.
Yeah. And I think there's also just the comedy of the picture of a bunch of camels standing on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Is a very funny image to me.
I think the last thing I want to mention is the build trees mechanic in Seven Wonders. Because it's like a build tree that you would experience in like a civilization game that Seven Wonders is trying to replicate with a draft element, but it doesn't have the need to like explain everything to you or show you a big web of how everything works together. Like you just kind of pick it up through playing, like what cards go into what other cards. So it's just like a simple little piece of text. Also placed similarly to the resource cost, so you understand how the mechanic works sort of intuitively. But it communicates like what happens next, and it's easy to pick up on. And it forces you to think about like what kind of build you might be doing in the middle of a game. Even your first game, you can consider a build of sorts from early on.
Yeah. I think that's it for me.
All right, then that does it for our episode on each of our 7 favorite board game mechanics. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you'd like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go on to our website, bgbcast.com, to find our episodes cataloged. So you can look up the board game discussions you're looking for there. Be on the lookout for our next episode on Architects of the Next Kingdom of the West Kingdom next there. You can find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, where you can buy our cool merch. And with all that said, let's hand it over to Matt Plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I've been streaming Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It's been a little up in the air recently. I'm kind of trying to rethink my schedule. But if you want updates on when I go live, you can follow me on there. You can go to my Discord server through there, where you can talk to us and other fans of our work. And you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet about when I go live, as well as make other tweets, especially when I make new videos on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/IEatAtSonic, IEatAtSonic. It's an older username.
You can also
find
him if you search Twack on YouTube.
Yeah. Though there is another one. It's just a random person.
Be wary.
Be wary. But you can tell it's me because I do video game analyses. I have a running series where I analyze the video game The Witness. And I'll have an upcoming video where I analyze the game Paradise Killer. So check that out if you're interested in some video game analyses.
Mm-hmm. I eat at Sonic, Matt Craig Gaming, Twack. I also can be found on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs if you want to, like, I don't know, glimpse into my twisted mind. I also stream very sparingly at the moment at twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That's twitch.tv/radical HAWKZ. Thank you for listening to our episode, everybody. We appreciate it. We will see you next time for our discussion on Architects of the West Kingdom.
See ya.